Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. There's a question I sometimes use to do a mic check with guests before we go on the air, and that question is, what was the first album you ever bought with your own money? It gets a guest talking so our engineer Irene can make sure the mic sounds good, but you know, we also sometimes find out a little bit about our guest. Now, normally you don't hear the answer because I ask it before the show. But tonight, singer-songwriter Eleanor Friedberger answers the question on the air with a soundtrack that firmly pegs her as a child of the 80s, even though it looks back to the 50s, and her new album sounds like the 70s. It'll all make sense later when Eleanor plays live. But here's a question for you. Have you read Colin McCann's novel, Let the Great World Spin? All the critics raved about how it's the best post-9/11 novel yet, which maybe it is, but not in the way you would think. Most of the story takes place before 9/11, and in fact, the novel starts with a brief prologue describing the sights and sounds of that morning in 1974 when Philippe Petit stood on the edge of one twin tower, preparing to walk across to the other. I read that prologue and just had to put the book down and collect myself. It is that extraordinary. Well, Colin McCann is back with a new novel called Transatlantic, and it's even more ambitious in scope. It crosses the Atlantic, it crosses centuries, it crosses the boundaries between fact and fiction. He still writes extraordinary language about ordinary sights and sounds, so we thought it would be fun to invite him to do a pick three for us. Colin McCann, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here.
So we've asked you for a pick three. The new book does have kind of three parallel stories running concurrently.
Yeah.
The different strands, to quote one of those three stories, which is that of the three-strand Irish peace process.
That's correct.
There's not a lot of music referred to specifically in this novel, although Maple Leaf Rag comes to play in one point. How careful are you in placing actual songs in your works?
Well, first of all, I mean, I'm deeply influenced by music, and I listen. I used to have this great stereo where I'd put in one CD and it would play the same album over and over and over again, so it would dissolve and become part of the language, I'm sure. You know, I wouldn't even recognize it anymore, like Astral Weeks or something like that. I'd play that and listen over and over again because, you know, language, you want it to operate like music on the page. You want it to form a sort of music into the reader's head. As for individual songs, I mean, it can be dangerous to, it's like putting in brand names, you know. It can be dangerous to put too many in a text. But something like Maple Leaf Rag is good because you want to give it that sort of like 20s twist and, you know. And just the word rag is fantastic because it refers to, you know, ragtime and it's all torn up and everything like that. And so, I enjoy the music of a sentence, yeah. I would say, mostly.
What was interesting about the use of Maple Leaf Rag to me was I kind of knew there were words to it, but I had never actually read them.
Right.
And obviously, in a work of literature, you can't put the melody in, so you give us words in the context of this groundbreaking transatlantic flight that's leaving Newfoundland and going to Ireland, which is one of the three transatlantic crossings.
Correct.
Along with an Irish maid going in the reverse direction during the years of the famine, and George Mitchell going from New York to Belfast.
And my favorite one of all, which is the one that stunned me into actually writing the book, is Frederick Douglass. In 1845, you know, as a slave. He went to Ireland and landed in Ireland 1845 as the famine was unfolding at his feet. And he went on a lecture tour as an abolitionist, and then found a country that was even worse off in his eyes than
his own people.
His own people down south who were enslaved.
Yeah. And his factual visit to Ireland becomes the catalyst for the fictional transatlantic journey.
That's right. Yeah, I like to mess with this idea of what's true, what's not true, what's history, what's not history, what's real, what's imagined. Because it always strikes me that the real is as imagined as the imagined is real. So you know, even, you know, some people say, well, journalism was in the newspapers, it was a fact. Well, but journalism is shaped too, you know, it's language, and we shape it in certain ways, and you know, we know how news gets shaped, and this idea that there is a fact that's arrivable at and a complete truth, we all know that you have to, you know, mistrust and distrust what's going on, and a fact when too deeply held can often become its exact opposite, a lie. And so fiction, nonfiction, shaping narratives is all very interesting to me.
And the idea of shaping narratives, of shaping language, the kind of musicality that you were talking about a moment ago, we associate that with the Irish.
Right.
And I think maybe it's Senator George Mitchell in the book who finds himself thinking about how the Irish have a song for somebody ends up thinking, or maybe it's Emily Ehrlich.
Yes, that's right.
The Irish have a song for everything.
Absolutely. Don't get me singing, though. I'm serious. Like, I do. My biggest problem in life is that I do sing, but I can't. So I'm the world's worst at a party, and like I'm the bloke who stands there in the corner and say, wait till you hear this one, you know, and like I'll sing Carrickfergus or Raglan Road or something like that, and totally off key. Beautiful songs though, they get away with it because the language in the songs happens to be so good.
On Raglan Road of an autumn day, I saw her first and knew that her dark hair would weave a snare that I might one day rue.
But yeah, I mean, All our love songs are sad, and all our fighting songs are merry, you know. Mm-hmm. What is wrong with us?
We're speaking with Colin McCann, the author of the new novel Transatlantic, and before that, of course, Let the Great World Spin and Zoli and others. Now, in picking some songs for us today, you chose not necessarily your favorites, but songs that would be interesting for our listeners to hear.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to have a rap about them, about some of these songs, and talk about them. And I mean, honestly, the songs I just mentioned, Raglan Road and Carrickfergus, would probably be the ones. I talked with an Irish writer many years ago, and he said that you know where you're from when you know where you want to be buried, which is a very interesting notion. But then he started also to talk about, you know what music you like the most when you know, when you can say which one you're going to have sung, not necessarily at your funeral, which is a bit ugh, but at your wake, you know, at 4 o'clock in the morning when everyone's drunk and like, you know, and dancing around, or, you know, wailing in the back garden. Mm-hmm. What's the song that they're going to sing for you? And I always thought Raglan Road or Carrickfergus would be the ones, but I wasn't going to get morose today. I wanted to choose some other ones.
I do have to say, though, Raglan Road, of all the many great Irish songs, that is one of my favorites.
Absolutely.
Raglan Road.
Yeah.
You chose for us today Mohilamar.
Yes.
My Gallant Darling, which has been sung for many a year by many an artist. Whose version do you like?
I like the Sting and the Chieftains. And when Paddy Maloney opens up with those pipes, I just think he opens up the heart of the song. And a funny thing is, I mean, okay, I'm going to be name dropping now, because I was just in Listowel last week and I met with Paddy, and I did the liner notes for the new Chieftains album, which is fun, you know. And you know, you get to, as life goes on, and you get to meet some of these people. But hanging out with him in a hotel in Listowel, when he takes out the pipes and people gather around, it's one of those magical moments. And I have to say, when Sting gets on this and he pulls that voice out of somewhere deep, I always think of Sting as being Irish anyway. He's from Newcastle.
Right.
But his affinity is deeply, deeply one that I respect and admire. And I'm actually working with him on a charity gig, and we're going to be in Chicago next week, and he's going to sing to a couple of hundred kids from high schools in Chicago, and it's all about.
And what will you be doing?
I will not be singing. I'll be sitting around talking about this charity, which is actually called Narrative 4. And we're trying to get kids from all around the world, from Haifa, from Belfast, from Haiti, from New Orleans, from Chicago in particular, together to acquire and retell one another's stories, which is a fantastic thing. Mm-hmm. And also, eventually, we'll do it musically. But Sting is one of those great artists who gets involved in all these good causes and stuff. And he certainly belts it out on this song.
It's a great version of Mohila Mar, My Gallant Darling, from Sting and the Chieftains. The song's called Mohila Mar, My Gallant Darling, an old Irish tune sung by Sting with the great Irish band The Chieftains from their 1995 record The Long Black Veil, picked for us by novelist Colin McCann, whose most recent album, recent book.
You know, I should have had an album. I definitely would have gone down in sales.
The most recent book is called Transatlantic, and it's all about the tangled web of transatlantic crossings that Colin have bound together the Irish people and the American people for a century and a half.
Yes.
And you too. I mean, your own transatlantic experience, I'm right. sure, must have colored this novel somehow.
Well, we're bound, as you know, in the most extraordinary way. I'm not sure that there are two nations that are so sort of helixed together. And America's always been important to the Irish imagination, to the idea of escape. But also, Ireland has been so important over here in producing cultural figures and producing presidents and people, but also your down-home American personality too. And then the reverse is very important as well. So people like Senator George Mitchell, who's in the novel, people like Frederick Douglass, they've gone across and they have affected with grace and dignity some of the proceedings in Ireland. And,
yeah. Well, and, you know, one of the Let the Great World Spin has sort of been acknowledged, as you know, as sort of the great post 9/11 novel. And yet 9/11 doesn't happen in the novel.
Right.
So confronting a tragedy doesn't necessarily mean describing it in the minutest detail and
right.
teasing every possible angle out of it. There are other ways of confronting.
Absolutely. When I wrote Let the Great World Spin, I used Philippe Petit's beautiful tightrope walk just as a pull-through analogy for what was going on. And of course, the soldiers were coming home from Vietnam, which mapped over onto the soldiers coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan and issues of religion, issues of technology and all these things. But so you work at it in a metaphorical way. And I think the transatlantic tries to do some of the same things. But I want to talk about faith and belonging and the fact that we are so incredibly connected to one another. But there are issues of the anonymous moment entering history. For example, when I wrote about Senator George Mitchell, who, as everybody knows, really, he went across and negotiated the peace process. And history can talk about him.
He went across and across and across.
Exactly. And on the first page, I have him changing a nappy, or rather a diaper.
A diaper, yeah.
A diaper. And so history doesn't change diapers. It just doesn't, you know. but fiction can. And so fiction can enter into those small little dusty moments or quiet moments or private moments that add up to the grand public moment too. We forget sometimes, you know, that Mr. Obama has to wake up in the morning and brush his teeth and, you know, do things that other people have to do too. We sort of tend to idealize them or freeze them in the aspect of their power. You know, they're there, boomf. But the fact of the matter is, he's just like you and me in so many ways. And that's what makes power, you know, a thing to negotiate and to think about. And, you know, it makes it vulnerable too, which is always, a thing to think about and investigate. You know, I like the fact that books can do that.
Yeah. We're speaking with the novelist Colin McCann, whose most recent book is called Transatlantic. One of the things that makes it great, Colin, is while I mentioned before you don't specifically quote a lot of songs, you write beautifully about sound and sometimes about the lack of sound. When the thrum of an airplane engine cuts off and the pilots who've just crossed the Atlantic for the first time are left not hearing the silence but kind of feeling the silence.
That's right.
I mean, do you listen to music when you're writing?
Absolutely. I mean, all the time. I mean, I now have the you know, I wish I had some sort of orchestra in my room that I could call up at any time. I have the iPod. I'm still trying to get used to it. I'm a bit of a techno idiot, and I don't know how to download all these things. And but I love music. Oh, not only just to block out the sound. I work at home, and I have three kids. So sometimes you just got to turn it up high and block out the sound. But sometimes you want to write a scene that's noisy. So you put on a band like, I don't know, if I wanted something noisy and Irish and a little bit raucous and sexy, maybe Thin Lizzy, you know, at a certain stage. Want something quieter, you know, musical, you know, you go in and take, I don't know, Martha Argerich, and you want to hear her, you know, boom.
The great Argentine pianist.
Exactly. Yeah. But if you want something with soul, you know, you go to someone like Van Morrison, who is the ultimate soul artist.
Now, you mentioned Astral Weeks a few minutes ago.
Yeah, every album.
Is that a touchstone for you?
Yeah, absolute touchstone. But, I mean, it wasn't the first album I bought. I remember buying Bowie was the first album I bought.
Which one?
Changes. So I was smuggling at home, and I also remember buying the Cars, and I don't know if the same album cover was on the front of the Cars album in the 70s of a woman with very provocative
and bright red lipstick.
Yeah. And do you know what I did? Like I cut the album cover down and turned it inside out and sellotaped it on the outside so my mother wouldn't think that I was listening to something really really naughty and vile. And you know, destroying my poor young Catholic mind. But music, there was there. Yeah, I remember buying those albums. And the first single I bought, this is really embarrassing. It was Radar Love by Golden Earring. Or is it the other way around?
No, that's right.
Radar Love by Golden Earring. And
we got a thing. It's called right. Radar Love.
Fantastic. My brother was a DJ as well, and he had a little company called Sounds OK, and you know, a few flashing lights, and he'd go around. So he had lots of albums at home all the time too, which was always great. I was always fascinated by the needle and how hairy the needle would get on a record as it went round and round and round, and the sound you get. This sounds so nostalgic now, because it's amazing the way time changes so quickly. But you remember the sound you get when you pluck the dust and the fuzz off the end of the needle and get the static going,
kind of thing.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I miss that. I must go ahead and buy one of those record players again.
Pick a song from Astral Weeks for us to listen to.
Madame George.
This is Colin McCann's Pick 3 on Soundcheck, and this is by Van Morrison.
The one and only Madame George. Look from outside, frosty window wraps. She jumps up and says, Lord have mercy, I think that it's the cops. And immediately drops everything she got down into the street below. And you know you gotta go. Sandy Road, throwing pennies at the bridges down below, and the rain, hail, sleet, and snow. Say goodbye to Madame George.
Song's called Madame George from Van Morrison and his 1968 album Astral Weeks. The novelist Colin McCann, his most recent book is called Transatlantic, which is out now and full of these crossings from Ireland to the U.S. and, or I should say, North America. Canada's involved as well.
That's right.
And then back again. And certainly Van Morrison is, that's a sound that has crossed the Atlantic with incredible ease over the past 40 years.
I remember hearing that song for the first time, and you hear the music first, and then you listen a time again, and you say, hold on one second, did he just say Dublin? And how could Dublin be in a song? Because we were quite isolated. I mean, and also, you know, in Ireland, we would think, you know, anything that was vaguely self-referential would be, you know, would be sort of like, oh, have to have, you know, conservative origins or something. Here's a man doing this sound that I'd never even heard before, and suddenly on a train from Dublin up to Sandy Row in Belfast. You mean you can sing about that sort of stuff? And then it's a transvestite, and you know what's going on here? And suddenly your world is open, bigger and bigger and bigger. And he makes that American journey. I mean, that's a big American sound with a you know, a very Irish lyric. And for me, it was that discovery that you could write about otherness, that you could go somewhere else. You didn't have to remain home in your little, you know, three-bedroom, four-bedroom, suburban, semi-detached house. And, you know, you could expand your mind and go outwards. And Van Morrison does that, like, really probably more than anyone.
How big a deal was it to have a song that in one line connected Dublin to Belfast?
Huge. Huge. And you know, you still don't see it all that much. I mean, in the novel, I try to connect Dublin to Belfast and show how sort of seamless they move between one and the other. But at that stage, you know, when bombs were going off in you know, along the train line that Madame George takes, when bombs were going off in London and even in Dublin, it was extraordinary to hear. To hear somebody do that. It's like somebody just whispered your name in a song or something like that. I remember another song where I did hear a name. Do you remember Dexy's Midnight Runners?
Come on, Eileen.
Yeah, Come on, Eileen. But they wrote another song. It was about, and I can't remember the name of it right now, but it goes, shut up, you don't understand it. Shut up, that's not the way I planned it. And it's Oscar Wilde and Brendan Behan, Sean O'Casey, George Bernard Shaw, Samuel Beckett. And then at the end, it fades off and I hear Edna O'Brien and then Sean McCann. right? It's my father. They'd obviously gone to a dictionary of writers. My dad was a writer, wrote 27 books. But they'd taken all the prominent ones. And then at the end, and I remember calling my dad into the sitting room and said, listen to this, Dad. And he was amazed too. Why would they invoke his name at the very end of a song? And I thought about that song for my pick three, but I thought,
a little too self-referential.
Yeah.
Now, why did I think your dad was a soccer player?
He was a soccer player. He started out as a soccer player. Then he became a reporter for the BBC. Then he moved back to Dublin and he became a journalist. And then he wrote books originally about soccer, about kids, seven kids' soccer books. And then he wrote about the history of the Irish theatre, about Sean O'Casey, about Brendan Behan, about the Irish theatre.
All right, so in this list of famous writers who get name-checked in this song that you were talking about, you mentioned Edna O'Brien.
Yes.
She somehow gets us to the third of your pick three.
Yeah, I saw Edna recently in London, and I remembered how over 20 years ago, I was living in Japan. I came back from London for publication of my very first book, which is a collection of short stories called Fish in the Slow Black River. Now, I was a little punk and I had a big black overcoat that was torn, red line, wearing a beret, and I thought I was going to go into this publishing company and everyone was going to turn around and be, you know, clap and all this sort of stuff. And I went in and nobody gave a damn, right? It was my publication.
Thank you
day.
For just, I saw the editing, the self-editing process there. That was nice.
And I wandered around and I was in a real funk and then from the end of the corridor, opened this door, coming out of her editor's room, and it was this beautiful woman with long red hair, Edna O'Brien, and she knew what it meant, and she sort of asked me to come along that evening to read with her at a Waterstones in London. And it was only years later that I was listening to this song by Dire Straits, and I realized that this song is about Edna O'Brien, this lady writer on the TV. She knew all about her history, you know. And so Mark Knopfler was obviously watching television some night, and on comes Edna O'Brien, and he decided to write a song about her. And I also think that Knopfler is one of the great musicians. He's so much fun to listen to, too.
Do you know the Cal soundtrack that he did?
Oh,
very, very Irish.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful soundtrack. But then, like, he had great fun with things like Money for Nothing and Communique and, you know.
Well, this song, Lady Writer, is from the 1979 album Communique by Mark Knopfler and the band Dire Straits. And it's the third of Colin McCann's pick three for us on Soundcheck today. His new book is called Transatlantic. It is well worth picking up. And Colin, it's been great spending some time with you. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Lady writer on the TV. Yeah, she had another quality. The way you used to look. And I know you never read a book. Just the way that her hair fell down around her face.
The R&B singer Erykah Badu is gearing up for a performance this weekend with the Brooklyn Philharmonic. We'll find out more. And later, a live performance from Eleanor Friedberger and her band. This is Soundcheck.